who would like to say something about your experience of the yoga this afternoon? Anything at all to report about it? Everybody's tired or shy? Anybody else want to make any
questions?
Yeah. 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 Were your knees hurting from being in the hands and knees, on your hands and knees? Okay, and did you use some cushioning to take care of it? Okay. So, what's the question? How you put out the welcome mat for the knee once it's hurting? Yeah. Is it still hurting?
No, it's okay. But
okay. Well, the first. Supposedly they fixed this too. So. So the first thing is to, you're in this posture, right? Were you okay up to that point? Or were your knees hurting before this, when you were doing this?
I just had a bad knee closure.
I see, so it hurts a lot. I mean, at other times. So how do you put the welcome mat out for it? You, as best you can, you turn towards the intense sensations and you open to them. And you notice how much you don't want to do that. And how much we're in the habit of pushing away intense sensations or creating some... Is that me? This guy worked on it for an hour and a half. Well, okay, so, and this is a question that is, I think, relevant to probably a lot of people, because we all have something or other that we really don't want to pay attention to or turn towards or honor because it's too painful or too annoying. So it becomes its own practice to kind of turn towards and open and put out the welcome mat to things that we most don't want to look at and feel and to hold them in awareness. So when you do that with pain, one of the first things you notice is that even naming it pain can make it worse. Maybe you could just call it discomfort. You know what I'm saying? Or intense sensation. And maybe there's a narrative, a story here about my knee. I don't know if you noticed it, but in the body scan, did you notice that I was talking about the knee? I wasn't talking about your knee. I almost never made it personal. The breath, the body. I don't use language that, for the most part, that says your breath, your body. And it's for a reason that we are so obsessed and personalized around the body that we don't actually treat it as a kind of natural phenomenon. So all of those are ways to kind of recognize how easily we get into the habit of turning away from or shutting off to discomfort and calling it pain, and then we have a pain problem. But if it's just the way it is in the knee, then we can actually make friends with the knee, understand the knee, do exercises with the knee or the back or whatever, and gradually over time see whether this is going to stay the same, get worse, or get better. And a lot of times, if it's getting worse, it's because we're not paying attention to it in a particular way. And if we care about optimizing our health and well-being physically and rehabilitating ourselves from injury, then the textbook hasn't been written on what's possible if we approach it in this kind of a way as opposed to avoid it in the ways that we usually do. So one of the ways to do that is to notice how much you're, be aware, be mindful of how much you're avoiding the knee. And then as soon as you're aware of that, then you have the alternative available to put the welcome mat up. Does that make any sense to you? Do you understand what I'm saying?
I'm not sure. I think for me, I think I avoided it. As a matter of fact, I think I shit on it often.
You what on it?
I shit on it.
You touch base with it. You check on it?
Mm-hmm. And it usually it involves kind of a sadness because it's been going on for a few years now and getting worse. And anxiety has created
yeah. Yeah.
And then the question I started thinking about here was how does putting up a welcome mat and being kind and welcoming the pain and the sadness and the anxiety, how does
it help you?
It seems like it's possible. Putting up the welcome mat and staying with the sadness, anxiety, pain.
Oh no, the welcome mat would include everything. It would include the sadness and the anxiety and the pain, and the welcome mat would be a big welcome mat. So it wouldn't just be the physical intensity, but also all your emotions around it. Now this doesn't mean that magically your knee is going to get better. It may not get better. From what you're saying, you're seeing that it's getting more problematic. Is that true?
Yeah.
Yeah. So at a certain point, you may have to, you know, have some kind of medical attention paid to your knee, just like millions of other people. What's that? I can't hear you. Hold the microphone up close.
After a few years of medical attention.
Okay, so that's part of the information that you have, is the doctors, the x-rays, whatever tests they've done, say that, you know, have some kind of diagnosis and some kind of prognosis, and that prognosis sometimes is like, it's going to get worse. We all know that one. I mean, everybody's had some kind of experience of that happening. I've certainly had experience of that happening. I have two artificial hips. And I didn't just wake up one day and decide, oh, I think I need new hips. No, there was an awful lot of pain along the way. And you know, and I thought, oh, yoga can do that. I mean, if I just do more yoga or, you know, intensify my practice or pay more attention to the hip joints and all of that, which I did for years and years and years, and it got progressively worse. But it's not the enemy, it's just your body. And it's just the law of impermanence, like, you know, we are aging. And sometimes these things happen in some people and they don't happen in other people. And so when you need medical attention, that becomes part of your mindfulness practice. And not just the medical attention and surgery, if that's what you need, but then recovering from the surgery. Tremendously valuable to bring the yoga into that. So this is just part of the human condition. And the invitation to turn towards and put out the welcome mat is like a universal. It's whatever comes up. We always have the option to do that rather than to go into just preoccupation with the anger and the sadness and the frustration and the difficulty. But in some sense, to just realize that this is part of the human condition and we'll integrate it into our practice and into our life.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was helpful to you, but I don't know what more to say. You know, it's your knee, so how do you want to be in relationship to it? It's your body, so how do you want to be in relationship to it? And every single one of us is facing that same kind of challenge. How are we going to be in relationship to the way things are in our life? Some of it has to do with the body. Some of it has to do with family and relationships. Some of it has to do with work. But the practice can be brought to all of it in just that kind of a way that doesn't create more suffering than necessary. Anybody else? Where's the second mic? So now the way we'll do it with these microphones, now that we have these wonderful microphones, is if you want it, raise your hand and he'll bring it to you or pass it to you. Okay, great. So we see you. Can you see me, by the way? Kind of? The lighting's not great, but I don't think these spotlights are going to help anything. We tried them yesterday. So you can see me well enough? What's that? No, that's horrible. Let's just keep it like this. Okay.
So I noticed while I was doing the yoga, for me it was much easier to be aware of my body than the body feels. Because what I feel is when I'm active, my body is active, so much easier to be aware of.
Sure. Let's just ask how many other people also found it was easier to be aware in the yoga of the body than in the body scan. Just raise your hands. So look around. You see you're not alone. And for some people, believe it or not, some people find it easier in the body scan than in the yoga. Is there anybody that sort of felt that it was easier in the body scan than in the yoga? See, look around. So we're not all the same in that regard. Rock climbing.
I wonder why not do work with mindfulness or something like this, or even with karate. Karate also, there is some mindfulness. It looks to me like there is no advantage on the yoga and mindfulness. So I wonder why on this limited to the core sitting, yoga, walking.
Like rock climbing or bicycling or parachute jumping? Yeah. There's no reason in principle why we couldn't include all sorts of other things, including dancing. But in MBSR, I mean, it is basically designed to be used in a hospital, in a clinic, with people who have major medical problems. So, and we only have 8 weeks with them, and they only come once a week. So we're doing what we think is most important, but yeah, if they go out dancing and they go out rock climbing or whatever, I don't think most of our patients will do rock climbing, but rock climbing is a beautiful mindfulness meditation from what I know, never having done any rock climbing. What's that? It feels the same. And since It better be mindful if you're way high up on a rock and one false move and, you know, you could fall, even if you have ropes. It's not fun. So, the feeling of the cliff face, the rock, with your feet, with your hands, with your body, with what's behind you, which is space, and what's in front of you, which is rock, and what's above you, which is more rock. This is a fabulous, and every move is unique. And you have to actually ask the rock what, how to hold it and how to move. So this is beautiful meditation. So it's not, the yoga is just a skillful means for helping people get back in touch with their bodies and how far they want to take it. I mean, there are said to be 84,000 yoga poses and at least 10 variations of each yoga pose. So that's an awful lot of poses. And if you think about the number of different sequences that we could mix them up in, that's infinite. So yoga can be as advanced and as challenging as you want. It can be at least as challenging as rock climbing. And in fact, you could do the yoga on top of a rock on the cliff and, you know, do something like this right on the cliff. And if you start to wobble, be careful you don't fall this way. I don't know if that answers your question. But yeah, the principle, you're in touch with something very profound, and that is, this has applications to everything. Because, why? Because it's the nature of your own mind in relationship with everything in the world of experience. So the more you are present with what you're doing, the more the body responds, the more the heart responds, the more you can be in harmony with your environment inwardly and outwardly. That can have huge effects over decades on the quality of your health and well-being. So all of your organ systems and all of your cells and all of your chromosomes and your brain are listening. They're really taking into account what you're doing. And more the research is showing that mindfulness reshapes the brain. It doesn't just change how the brain, you know, activates in certain regions. That activation, through the process of neuroplasticity and ongoing repetitive practice, actually changes the brain in very interesting ways that have to do with a greater sense of inner balance, well-being, not so much caught in the narrative networks, but more in the experiential network. And these things can have very profound effects on your health and well-being, which is one of the reasons that we do it in the hospital, is that people get better. They feel much better. Even if they have chronic diseases, they wind up feeling much, much more in charge of their lives and much more able to deal with stress, pain, and illness in ways that are life-enhancing and enhance the quality of life. And if you're young and healthy, then what better time to really cultivate these practices and carry them through the rest of your life in ways that get increasingly wonderful and increasingly deep as you get older. So it's very, very beautiful. And I know many, many people, myself included, that, you know, came to these practices when they were in their early 20s or even younger. And it can make a huge difference in the direction that your life takes. Many different ways. So thank you. Okay, so look around for who wants the mic. And yeah.
I've noticed, maybe it's a bit similar to what...
Keep holding the mic.
So maybe I want to share something that I think is
really
similar to what Justin said. I've noticed today that there is a big difference for me in the capacity to be aware. And depending on how much movement there is in the practice. When I think of this, it was the easiest for me during the yoga. It was kind of more difficult during the eating, but still there is a bit of a movement, so I could do it. But the sitting, with no
rest. What about the body pain?
I fell asleep.
Okay. And the sitting?
The sitting was the hardest for me. And it's not a surprise because I've been practicing, not very much, but long the next years and here and then. And I find it impossible to concentrate on the breathing and not be lost in thought. So I shared two things. One is the connection between movement and awareness. And the other thing is the disappointment I feel that I do not feel like there is an improvement in the capacity to be more aware during sitting meditation. And I think, I'll just add that it might have to do with the fact that I don't do it every day or regularly, but that's here and then. And in the last year, I promised myself every day that tomorrow.
Yeah, right.
So it would be very helpful for me if you could say something about the barrier. I feel there is a barrier that holds me or makes it difficult to start. And of course, I can talk about busy and maybe children, but I think it's not.
Good intuition. Yeah. Do you remember how we started last night? We started with, what brings you here? Why are you here? Why do you think we did that? It's because motivation is everything. If you don't have the motivation, it sounds like you do have the motivation. And you're asking, how do I take that motivation and actually make it real so that I will practice this sitting meditation, which is very difficult for you. And so we have all sorts of reasons not to do it, barriers. It's a wonderful intention to always be ready to do it tomorrow. But tomorrow never comes. So all you have to do is switch it to today. And then it gets tough. Okay? When are you going to do it? You have all the motivation in the world. But when are you going to do it with little children in the house? How are you going to do it? And maybe you can't. I mean, maybe it's just not possible to find the time. Or maybe it won't be the same time every day, depending on how old they are and whether they nap or whether whatever. But maybe it's possible. I don't know. You'd have to decide that because it has to do with your values and your time situation. I mean, if children sleep well, then maybe you can get up a little before they wake up or a little before you need to wake to deal with all the work of being a parent and just find some time for yourself. Even 10 minutes. Okay, I'm not talking about like an hour or 45 minutes, but even 10 or 15 minutes, you do it every day for a year? That's extraordinary. A lot of it is the intention and then the execution of the discipline. The 10 minutes, it's 10 timeless minutes. So outside of time, 10 minutes can be profoundly valuable. And since you have this intuition that it's easier to do it moving, and that's true for many, many people, but you can actually develop the same quality of awareness and even deeper, perhaps, in stillness. And it's not about stillness or about moving, it's about living. So from that point of view, even if you don't sit, but you love you love the benefits of being present in your life, then you can practice in many, many different ways. No one says you have to sit. Only you would say you have to sit or you want to sit, and then you can make that happen. But, you know, your being present with your children is probably the highest meditation practice of all. And that's perpetual movement, usually. Sometimes stillness, though, when you're holding them. How old are they?
5 and 2.5, so it's a lot of running after.
A lot of running in. Yeah.
A lot of movement.
Okay, but sometimes they fall asleep, don't they? On your body?
Yes.
Sometimes they, or you hold them? So that's a perfect time for stillness. Okay? And you can, you know, and you can actually do it in the hammock. You know what hammocks are? There are all those things outside that you... So if you have a hammock, you can rock with your baby in the hammock. Is that moving or stillness? The hammock's moving, but are you moving? So there are all sorts of ways that you could bring this into your life. And the stillness is not the most important thing. And then in some stages of our life, what's wrong with moving and mindfulness in that way? And then there's also another option, another possibility. And that's one of the reasons I gave you the homework last night. When you get into bed, you've always got the opportunity to actually meditate for a short period of time before going off to sleep. Because by then, you know, the day's over. So you can take 5 or 10 minutes and just, you can do it lying down, you can do it sitting. And then in the morning, before you jump out of bed, even if you're not going to go and sit someplace else, just lying down. And if you do that, you're sandwiching the whole day with these 5 or 10 minutes of mindfulness. If you do that more or less every day for 10 or 20 years, I'm not joking, it makes a difference. It really makes a difference. And the only force that I know of that could get you to do such a strange thing for 10 or 20 years is love. Love for life, love for clarity, love for kindness, love for you being your best self, you being your most balanced self in the face of endless stress. The stress of living in the Middle East, the stress of being, you know, in Israel, the stress of life in general, the pace of life. I mean, there's no end to it, the stress of being a parent. But there's also all this joy. So why not be in touch with the full spectrum of life moment by moment, and then navigating between the stress and the joy is very different than if you never nurture the joy and the beauty and the silence and the stillness. And then it works beautifully with moving, so that sooner or later it's all the same. All the same. T.S. Eliot called it, wrote beautifully about it in his last great poem called Four Quartets. But he called it this, at the still point of the turning world. So there's movement and stillness. There's stillness inside movement, movement inside stillness. So it's not that difficult. The most important ingredient is your motivation. If you want to do it, you'll find a way. Does that help at all?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. The other alternative is, and this won't work, but I could come home with you and make you do it. Do you know what I'm saying? That won't work. Your kids might love it. yeah, so you see, nobody can do this work for us. And ultimately, we have to inquire very deeply what we might miss by not taking care of our moments and by establishing this kind of way of being for ourselves. What might be lost if we just get carried into the stress and the chaos and the living without awareness? And 10 or 20 or 30 years can go by. What might we not see? Or not feel, or not express. And that's really where the motivation might come from to make the practice a central aspect of your life. The sitting's the least of it. The question of moving or stillness, that's the least of it. The most important piece is living your life from moment to moment as if it really matters and being present for it with some degree of spaciousness so that you can hold the complexity without being completely overwhelmed by it. Is it hard? Yeah, as I keep saying, this is the hardest work in the world, but the alternatives are worse. All the alternatives. Mindlessness is worse. The consequences of not being present are really unhealthy. So thank you. Yeah. So pass that one around if anybody's, look around you with me. So remember, we're talking about the yoga. Are you talking about the yoga? Okay. Yeah, of course.
About putting up the welcome mat for
yes.
So I'm wondering if that's the general response, okay, whether it's physically or emotionally, because it seems like so many times you can't avoid it and you have to deal with it. What if you can't? Are you still?
What if you can't avoid it?
Yeah, what if you can't, I don't know.
Ignore it?
You can ask them. Beer.
Yeah, sure.
So,
take an aspirin, drink beer as long as that works for you.
So when, you know, we're always encouraged to kind of be with the pain. So when...
Well, wait a minute. You say we're always encouraged. We've been here since last night. So this is a very short period of time we've been together. And I'm not telling you to always be with the pain. It's fine to take an aspirin if you want to. Or go out and have a beer.
It feels like it has consequences, but if you take part of the pain spectrum off, then you make part of the pleasure spectrum.
Well, that's really a good question and really good to investigate for yourself. Because really you're asking about your own life. So there's no prescription. There's no like, well, this is the catechism of mindfulness. Okay? Never drink beer, never take aspirin, always turn towards the pain and tough it out. Or breathe it away. Or whatever, you know, cliche comes up in the mind around the meditation practice. But it's none of that. It's simply living life with awareness. And with some degree of emotional intelligence, not just directed towards other people, but also towards ourselves. So what makes the most sense? You know, a lot of the time when things are not too bad, denial is a very useful strategy. People use it all the time. As they say, denial is not just a river in Egypt. Have you heard that one? But again, it comes down to your motivation. What do you care about in your life? And if you've tasted enough of this practice of mindfulness to feel like it has some validity for you, not in general, not because there's literature that says brains change or genes change or whatever, then try it out for 10 or 20 years and see what happens. And I'm not joking. I'm not joking. I mean, I got into this when I was 22 years old in a formal way. Okay, and now I'm 68. It's amazing how fast it goes. But the practice has been a very, very integral part of my life for, you know, far more than half of my life. It's not an accident. I mean, I actually don't think I'd be alive if it weren't for the practice. But it's a personal choice. It's not like, you're joining a cult or something like this. It's a personal choice to live your life in a certain kind of way and then find other people with who share your values so that from time to time at least you get together and you practice together and you learn from each other. We're all learning from each other. I think I said in the MBSR classroom, we're all learning from each other. And sometimes I feel, you know, people pay to, you know, for MBSR in the hospital, but I feel like I should be paying them because I'm learning more from them than they are from me. So no one ever stops growing. The Dalai Lama is continuing to learn and grow, and it's amazing to see how fast he learns and grows. He doesn't think, I'm the Dalai Lama, I can take the month off. You know, I don't have to meditate anymore. I'm already at the top of my game. You know, no, he gets up at 3:30 in the morning. 3:30 in the morning, and he practices for 4 or 5 hours before anything. And none of us could keep up with him. He travels all over the world, and you know, he doesn't seem to get jet lagged. And he's 10 years older than I am.
In your opinion, you think that numbing is something, numbing in general, does that necessarily mean that you're cutting a little bit of that clarity in general?
No, I think it can be specific that, you know, if there's certain ways in which you can numb emotional pain and it works for you in the short run, it's okay. But you have to ask yourself, are there larger costs? Now, unless, you know, we had a much longer and deeper conversation without the 135 other people in the room, there's no way that I could respond any more than that. But I don't have to, because you're your own teacher. So if you go with the numbing, that's going to teach you. It will teach you. It may be a very painful lesson, but you'll learn sooner or later what the consequences of numbing as a solution to particular kinds of emotional pain are. The alternative, and maybe you have intuition about that, and you'll be deciding for yourself. But, you know, the other option is to actually turn towards it, not numb, or notice how much you want to numb. And remember, I didn't say jump into the deep end of the swimming pool. I said put your little toe in the water and just test it a little bit. Just peek at the hurt. Just peek. One breath in and out. Can I manage that? And then maybe back to something safer. And then maybe a little bit later, another peek. And what you're doing is you're familiarizing yourself with a certain kind of territory that actually you don't want to go anywhere near. And that's why you want to numb. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a form of dissociation. That is not the path to health and well-being. But as a coping strategy, sometimes that's often our only option, especially when we're little and we don't know a lot about safety and where to find it. But when we're adults, we have the opportunity to actually take a look at what would be the healthiest, wisest path. And then life is going to teach us that lesson whether we like it or not, sooner or later. But there's something to be said when you're young to testing these waters in some kind of consistent way over days, weeks, months, and years, and going and finding teachers that you feel are inspiring, practice with them, and read books that you find inspiring and practice out of the books. But the most important book or teacher is you yourself. If you pay attention and really listen deeply to what you're saying, what your body is telling you, what your heart is telling you, what your pain is telling you. Does that come anywhere close to welcome? And we can talk about it more if you like, you know, informally. So look around and see. We'll take one or two more and then... Where did the microphone go? Did it go anywhere? No. No one wants... Okay. Hold. Okay, it's going over here, so why don't you wait one moment. And then, okay?
I wanted to ask something more on a broader perspective, psychologically, culturally.
Uh-oh.
But this is so intuitive, you know, why is the Western society, is it so difficult to implement it? Is it so we need the schools for adults? Why, during the generations, hasn't there been an evolutionary benefit of this way of thinking?
Well, we, you know, maybe the pressures for evolutionary selection of this are just coming online, and maybe they are going to be very, very challenging, and so there's potentially. The cultural evolution is going to be very rapid. It might have to be very rapid, or we may not survive as a species. As to what the impediments and the barriers are, we could talk about that endlessly, just the way we could talk about philosophy endlessly. It's fascinating. But I don't think it will help any of us to actually practice better. I think that, and in a retreat that's this short, I think that probably it's best to just keep our focus, at least for now, in the nitty-gritty of the practice and how we implement it in our lives. And then leave that larger question for maybe tomorrow afternoon, if we get to it at all, where I think it's really important to sort of have a very big picture of this. Because if this is something we're going to engage in a serious way in our own lives, it's really helpful to have a larger narrative. Even if it's wrong, even if it's partly, you know, based on guesswork. And so it's a really interesting question. I can tell you, I'm pretty sure, that evolution selected for mindfulness in the sense that in the old days when we were running around on the savannah, if we were not in our bodies and aware of the environment, we didn't make it to childbearing age. You know, we needed to know where the predators were that were going to eat us, you know, and to pay really close attention to all the signs that native peoples live in an entirely different universe. They are very, very deeply in touch with nature and with their own bodies in a way that, you know, civil society has kind of made somewhat unnecessary. But it's in our DNA, for sure. Thank you. Okay, so this will, you can pass that microphone off, and this will be the last one.
Thinking about the question, it gets more complicated, so try to make it as simple as I can. I guess that I think maybe I'm not fully understanding the connection between body and mind. From the field I'm coming, I believe in way of practicing and encouraging people to meet their emotional experiences, you know, and listen to them and be aware of them. And then I think we can choose what to do, overcome it. Facing physical things, I find it's different to me. For me. I have back problems, and the mindfulness yoga was hard for me. And it took me back to what I said yesterday, to see pain, and then I was intimidated. I said, oh my God, I have my back problem for 30 years, but the last 7 months, it's all going more intensively. And I thought, oh my God, I should stop. What should I do? Mm-hmm. I tried the thing up. Now, I know there is a pain that we can do things in spite of the pain, but then I can't differentiate because sometimes if we do things in spite of the pain, we can cause damage.
Oh yeah, and you'll pay for it later.
How do we know when we can, you know, do things with the pain and it's okay, and it's the mind signals us, the brain signals us the pain to, you know, that the body will protect itself. But sometimes the mind, the brain sending signals of pain, and we have to watch it.
Yeah.
Because we might cause damage. So it's complicated, but how do we differentiate between different pain, physical?
Well, you do it by very, very slowly and by experimenting with tiny little doses of moving in ways that don't generate pain and increase your degrees of freedom. You might want to do it with a physical therapist. All of what physical therapy is yoga. Hopefully it's done mindfully, because if it's not, the physical therapy can actually injure you instead of help you. I see heads nodding. But there's no sort of magical formula. It's like everybody's body's different. And the question is, can you experiment and investigate what's going on with your body, maybe in collaboration with your doctor or a physical therapist or surgeon or whatever, and get their recommendations about what might be safest, and usually what they'll say is, I don't know. So you're on your own, kind of. But if you want to be able to move 20 or 30 years from now, it might be really valuable to experiment very, very intentionally, but very, very slowly and carefully, so you don't make things worse and wind up injuring yourself, to reclaim what's reclaimable in your body and to grow it. And I think that in my experience, that's what happens to large numbers of people in MBSR, is they kind of wake up to that possibility and then they continue to practice. MBSR is only 8 weeks long, but many people are practicing 20 or 30 years later. And I know, because they come back and they ask for new tapes or new CDs, or, you know, just come to our annual conference or whatever. So a small number of these people from many years ago, we still see them. And so this is a kind of lifetime's work. And, you know, of course you could just say, do the meditation practices that don't involve any kind of moving or stretching the envelope, and they could be just as powerful, but they're not going to actually potentially improve your body. Do you know what I'm saying? How long have you been practicing mindfulness? 7 months. So did I say already that, like, in some traditions they measure your age by how long you've been practicing? So you're like a baby. You're 7 months old. You know, congratulations. So, you know, this is a lifetime's work, and it's kind of an adventure. So, and it's like a big, important adventure to you, because it's your life. So what do you care about? Again, it comes back to motivation. If you really care about a certain kind of autonomy, independence, and not giving up on your body, then you'll experiment to whatever degree it takes. And you'll make mistakes. Will you make mistakes? Of course you'll make mistakes. And you'll learn from the mistakes. Most of what we learn from our mistakes. And then we grow from that. So the important thing is not to really harm yourself or really injure yourself. And that, you know, there are people out there who have lots of knowledge about the body. You start to try to find them, cultivate some kind of, you know, relationship with people who know a lot more about the body a lot more about yoga, a lot more about therapeutic yoga, a lot more than you do, and then see if that's helpful. And 9 out of 10 of those people might not be helpful. The 10th person might be helpful to you. And it's not just yoga, you know, craniosacral, osteopathy. I mean, there are all sorts of things that could be valuable in some situations and could be useless in other situations. So there's no prescription. There's no one sort of algorithm or catechism for doing this work, which is fine because that means we have to take responsibility for our own lives. That's the foundation of MBSR. It's the foundation of mind-body medicine, is that people have to take some degree of responsibility and engage in their own movement towards greater levels of health and well-being. The doctor can't do it for them. The meditation teacher can't do it for them. The yoga teacher can't do it. You're the only one that can do it. And your condition is not a problem. It's an opportunity. You get to work with that. And it will teach you everything you need to know. And it's best to proceed cautiously and patiently and slowly with a very, very long time horizon, that you're not going to give up on yourself just because things aren't going as fast as you like. You know, remember people got impatient about how slowly I was doing the body scan. Well, we get impatient about how slowly we're healing or not healing. And we can get very anxious and very upset and very impatient about that. So this is about emotional intelligence. It's about regulating our own emotions around issues like our body and our health and our well-being and our aging and all of that kind of stuff. Okay, how are we going to be in relationship to all of that? That's the challenge, and that's what mindfulness offers. But it's not a formula. It's not like, you know, here's the prescription, take it. It's much more engaging than that. It requires personal responsibility. So let's have a period of silent walking practice. I will bring you back with the bells. Don't go too far away, because I'm not going to go chasing all over the place with the bells. So I'll just ring the bells out there. So, and if you don't hear the bells, but you see everybody moving back towards the entrance of the hall, you might think to yourself that, oh, he rang the bells, but I didn't hear them. And if everybody's moving towards the hall, you should move towards the hall. And this will be a relatively brief period for walking. So I'll ring the bells. We're still in silence. You're welcome to walk in the hall. And take good care of yourself so that, you know, the ground is uneven. If there's not enough light, try to walk someplace where there's light and the ground is even. And try to stay in the present moment as best you can, moment by moment and step by step.